This is Grant Reher with an additional introduction to the interview with District Attorney Fitzpatrick that you're about to hear. This interview was taped on October 1st, prior to the story and allegations involving Peter Rausch. That is why the DA was not asked about this issue. Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest today is Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick. He's currently serving in his seventh four-year term and is up for re-election on November 5th. Others appearing on the ballot are Democrat and Working Families candidate Charles Keller and Conservative and Independence Party candidate Gary Levine. District Attorney Fitzpatrick and Charles Keller were previously interviewed individually on the program, and you can find those interviews on the Campbell Conversations webpage at WRVO.org. The program you're about to hear was originally intended to be a debate, and I want to take a couple minutes to explain how and why I'm speaking with just Mr. Fitzpatrick. We issued invitations to participate in a debate on August 27th. Leading up to that date, we did an analysis of the race, seeking to determine whether we should include third-party candidate Gary Levine in that invitation. A half-hour broadcast is a limited amount of time, and we want to provide the most relevant information that we can for our listeners. As of August 27th, we determined that there was little evidence of an active campaign on behalf of Mr. Levine's own election using the traditional markers for that activity. We also floated that conclusion by two independent observers of local politics. As a result of that process, we went forward with invitations to Mr. Fitzpatrick and Mr. Keller. We also informed each of them that should only one candidate agree to participate in the debate, we would go forward with an individual interview of that candidate. This is a practice that we have followed on this program in past debates involving other races. Unfortunately, Mr. Keller ultimately declined our invitation, and so, as we said to both candidates, I am here now with District Attorney Fitzpatrick. District Attorney Fitzpatrick, welcome back to the program, and I want to thank you for being willing to debate. I regret that it didn't materialize.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the invite.
So my role here is not to be your debating partner, but
my debating coach, maybe.
but I, what I'll do is I'll ask you some questions that are derived from the criticism that your opponent has made. And I'll just say at the outset for our listeners, one topic that I'm not going to be asking about is the Austin Pratt case, because you and I discussed that at length in our earlier conversation, and listeners who are interested in that can find that previous interview, again, as I said, on WRVO's webpage. But I do want to ask you about a more general criticism, and it's one that this case supposedly speaks to, which is your level of engagement at this point with the workings of your office. Mr. Keller has suggested that after 28 years, the office is sort of on an autopilot and it needs a reinvigoration. Now, I won't ask you if you are still engaged, because I presume you're going to say to me that you are.
Engaged in what? No.
But what I want to ask you instead is, what is it that you do in order to stay engaged? Because, you know, let's admit it, 28 years is a long time to be in one position, and it would be easy at some point to kind of start mailing it in. So what do you do to sort of stay actively engaged in what's going
on? Yeah, well, first thing, there are some things that run very smoothly, which should not be a pejorative reference to the office. It should be a positive thing. We're going to undergo a massive change in our entire procedural operation come January 1st. And to me, it would be good to have somebody at the helm who's very, very experienced and prepared and knowledgeable about what's about to come down upon us, which we may have time to discuss. In terms of my engagement, you know, I have 50 assistant DAs. I've got another 50 people who are support staff. I've got 15 sworn police officers. You know, I know every one of them. I see almost every one of them on a daily basis during the week. I'm engaged in their trials. The more serious the trial, the more engaged I am. On homicide cases, we have a very intensive screening process where the ADA comes in and presents his or her facts and theory and order of proof to a senior collection of attorneys. And then ultimately, they'll bring the finished product to me before the trial starts. So it's a catchy soundbite. It's a nice cliche, but I'm extremely, extremely engaged in the operation of my office and very proud of that.
So let's talk about what this thing is that's coming down. And also more generally, I wanted to ask you, when we talked last time, a month and a half ago or so, we discussed some of the initiatives that your office had been pursuing in recent years. Mm-hmm. Here I want to look more ahead. Like, what new things would you have in mind that you would like to do in a next term, in an eighth term? And if you want to talk about this thing that's coming down, let's hear that too.
Yeah, I think that's going to take the immediate attention of my professional life for at least the first several months of 2020. And why is that? Well, let's talk about the three phases. One is bail. And as I discussed with you before, bail is not a big issue in Onondaga County. We do not seek nominal bail. We don't criminalize poverty. I don't ask judges to set $50 or $100 bail. I ask judges to set bail when the person is a danger, where there's a likelihood that the person won't reappear or the person has a history of not reappearing. And my goal is to keep this community safe. And I make bail recommendations consistent with that obligation and have done that for two decades. You know, the second area is speedy trial. We now have to have everything on our plate ready to go within 15 days unless we make a specific application to a judge to extend that 30 days. That is just not possible. We're trying to convince, I say we, me and my brother and sister DAs are trying to convince the legislature that, look, we understand why you did what you did, but you really have unintended consequences. Because I don't think people in Albany, you know, want anarchy, and I think they, in their heart of hearts, want public safety and they want fairness. I believe that to be true, regardless of what political party they belong to. But there are serious, serious unintended consequences of that. It is not physically possible to do all of the scientific tests in a case within 15 days. Mm. Blood tests. People say, well, why don't you have the blood results? Because it's a chemical process that takes weeks. Mm. I can't tell you what the guy's BAC was or whether or not the guy was under the influence of some type of opioid within 15 days, and no one else can. And then the third thing is discovery. And since I've taken office, I was a defense lawyer for 5 years before I took office, and we had this draconian system in the state of New York where you didn't get discovery until after you had selected a jury. How unfair is that? And I recognize that. And I basically superseded the law and said, no, we're going to have, with ethical lawyers, where there's no witness intimidation involved, we're going to have an open file discovery process. But now, again, that 15-day, you know, metric comes into play. We've got to turn everything over. And I don't have any problem with open file. What I have, you have. That's just basic fairness, and it's gonna be a problem. Let me just give a quick example. You're in your bed. You wake up. You see somebody purloining your stereo. You call the cops. He's caught on the front lawn. By law, that individual, regardless of his record, has to be let out the next day. A colleague of mine in another part of the state has a drunk driver. He killed somebody. He's an Akwesasne native, which means he has ample opportunity to flee. But because of the nature of the charge, manslaughter in the second degree, come January 1st, he'll have to be released on bail. Hmm. That's not a system that bodes well for success and public safety. So I'm preparing, and we have been preparing since May, to deal with this, and we have all the stakeholders involved, the judiciary, the police, the town and village courts, and the defense bar.
So let's look beyond that. You get that squared away in a few months. Do you have thoughts about new initiatives that you may want to put forward in a new term?
Yeah, what I've been doing successfully just recently, and when I say recently, maybe about 8 or 9 months ago, is I have this program. I call it an amnesty program. A lot of impediment to people getting jobs, getting back on their feet, are minor warrants that they have pending. Could be a license suspension because they forgot to address a speeding ticket in any part of the state. So I've had these amnesty days, mm-hmm. where people can come in. We have a judge there and an ADA, and we clean up the record so that if the person, God forbid, is stopped for some reason, the cops don't have to arrest them because there's a warrant pending. Plus, they can apply for a job, because it's just another example of what my whole approach to the criminal justice system is. It's, let's find out, why did this person commit a crime? Who was hurt by the crime? And what can we do to make the victim whole? And what can we do to get the defendant back on his or her feet? We have, I think at last count, 7 or 8 diversionary courts in Onondaga County. I want to make sure that those are continued to run well. We've got drug court, community court, opioid court, mental health court, veterans court, integrated domestic violence court, and I'm sure I'm leaving some out. But those are specific courts designed to deal with specific problems. The domestic violence offender is not the same as the shoplifter, who is not the same as the drug addict. And I recognized that back in 1992, and I've done many, many programs similar to that since then. But now we have judges that are specially trained in how to deal with that. I'm very, you know, very happy that Rory McMahon, who's a former ADA of mine, he runs the opioid court. Mm. And people, somebody said to me, well, why do you need an opioid court if you already have a drug court? And I say, well, a drug court is like a hospital. An opioid court is like the emergency room. Mm. And that's the difference. And it's so far. And, you know, the object is let's save lives. Let's lock up people that are truly incorrigible, that are dangerous, that deserve to be in jail, despite all of our efforts to help him or her. And let's divert people that really should be diverted and get them back on their feet.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick. So just to be clear there, then, and something you said earlier, you're planning more of those amnesty days then in the future, isn't
yes, yeah. and in more parts of the city, the first one, and in the county as well.
Okay.
But I think the north side is my next target area because we have such a huge new American population in that area, and to many of them, the criminal justice system is very confusing. That's why I have an actual immigrant outreach worker who goes and tells these people, look, despite what you may have come from, where the police are corrupt, where the prosecutors are on the take, this is a community where we want to protect you and welcome you. And they in some ways can be the perfect victims because they don't understand the system. Mm-hmm. And I've seen an influx of people, gangbangers who, you know, try to prey on our new Americans, and that as you might expect, infuriates me.
You know, I was going to ask you this question later, but since you've brought this up, it's a good time to do it. It is about the question of immigration and, in particular, refugees, because, mm-hmm. you know, Syracuse is one of the main resettlement cities that the federal government has designated. But there's also been this enormous amount of controversy and conflict over immigration and refugees, and now over the number of refugees that the country will take in mm-hmm. next year. So on that point, I was wondering, does your office collect or do you know whether the refugee population here in Syracuse, does it have a higher are those folks more likely to commit crimes?
Well, I can tell you from personal direct knowledge that absolutely not.
Okay.
It's an incredibly lawful community. It's unbelievable how few crimes we get committed by the people that we have welcomed here. You know, one thing that I have done, Grant, that kind of piggybacks on your last question too, is I've just started kind of a more aggressive approach to landlords who ignore lead paint in their homes. And I'm not looking, you know, oh, you have lead paint here, bang, throw them in handcuffs. Far from it. We're only prosecuting the landlords who consistently and methodically ignore the requests from the city to get lead abatement. And that piggybacks with the immigrant community because, I mean, can you imagine, you know, I'm leaving Somalia because of civil war, because of religious persecution, because of domestic violence, and now my kids are going to be poisoned in America. I think everybody listening to my voice, regardless of how you stand on immigration, would think that's an unacceptable scenario.
And I just want to let our listeners know that several weeks ago we did do a program about lead paint and lead poisoning mm-hmm. in Syracuse, so you may want to take a listen to that. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick, who is pursuing re-election in next month's local elections. So another theme of criticism that I wanted to ask you about is you have been criticized for filing paperwork to begin drawing your pension while still serving and being paid a salary if you're reelected. This is often in the media called double dipping.
Right.
It's legal, but as I understand it, you're just 3 years beyond the cutoff for currently serving employees. And in other words, you made the cut by 3 years to be able to do this. Now, I know you've discussed this elsewhere in the media, but you haven't discussed it here on this program. So can you just explain that decision to our listeners?
Yeah, first of all, I haven't filed the papers yet.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. I understand my opponents, what they're saying, that I'm already collecting my pension.
I thought I had read that on Syracuse.com.
Yeah,
okay.
Actually, it's interesting. One of my opponents is collecting two pensions, but that's neither here nor there. It's a very, very simple answer. If I were to die after 40 years of service, without seeking my pension. My wife gets a check for 1 year, or maybe I think it's a year and a half of my salary.
So it's not vested then in that sense?
It is vested, but that's the law. If I collect my pension and take the death benefit, which is my intention to do, which is, in other words, a reduced pension, and I die in office or at some other point in my life, my wife gets my pension for the rest of her life.
Okay.
I would defy anybody who loves their family to tell me to my face that I would not do what you're doing. And it's a very, very simple. I don't make the rules, but I'll play by them.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we've covered that one then. Let's get back to some policy issues then. I had a question about the Raise the Age legislation, which began taking effect, I believe, about a year ago.
Right.
And now the age, I think maybe as of today, has been put to where the point where 17-year-olds facing felony charges will not be tried as adults. And I guess there are some exceptions to that, which you may want to discuss.
Sure.
But those backing the legislation have pointed to evidence that 16 and 17-year-olds who were in adult prisons and have been in adult prisons more likely to get abused, more likely to recidivate when they get out, and then have also pointed to the racial imbalance in the proportions of those incarcerated. So, first of all, comment on how this change is going so far, do you think?
It's actually going well. I'm concerned about resources in family court for Onondaga County and the rest of the state. But let me just say a couple of things about that. The scenario you described of putting youngsters, however heinous their crimes may have been, with hardened adult criminals is something that I pointed out was completely irresponsible and made no sense. In 1994, I was on a commission appointed there by then-Governor Mario Cuomo, and I made that comment, and I was somewhat criticized by Department of Corrections people that not understanding their role in their job. Well, here we are 20 years later, and it's now the law in the state of New York, which makes absolutely perfect sense to me. The second thing I want people to understand is that prior to the enactment of the law, 95% of the teenagers, the eligible youth, 17, 16, 17, and 18, made it through the criminal justice system in Onondaga County without any criminal record whatsoever, 95%. Mm. In other words, the 16-year-old gets arrested for shoplifting. We would do in county court or the local court, city court, exactly what they're doing now in family court. The belief is that family court is better trained, better equipped to deal with youthful issues. I hope that's true, and I know we have some outstanding family court judges in this community, but I hope they're given the resources to deal with it because it just makes so much sense to deal with issues now, particularly addiction, mental health issues, before the kid becomes, God forbid, a school shooter. I mean, I've got a kid we just arrested a week ago, as you and I are speaking, 16 years old, methodically, according to his statement, and he's presumed innocent, I'm not going to mention his name, methodically tracked down a guy that he was afraid of and executed him. And obviously that case doesn't belong in family court. That's on my lap, on my watch.
And that person would be tried as an adult then?
That person would be tried as an adult.
Because of the nature of the crime?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. So, some of my colleagues tend to be chicken little, the sky is falling. I just think that it could have been done in a much smoother, much better way. And again, I'll go back to that word resources. I hope that that the legislature is willing to invest in these kids and try to save them.
If you're just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Onondaga County District Attorney Bill Fitzpatrick. So you've spoken to this, I think, already, but I wanted to see if you had other things to say about it. Again, I'm going back to your principal opponent, Chuck Keller. When he talked to me in his individual interview, he really emphasized this idea of what he called redemption, that this was going to be really important to him, taking more steps to keep offenders, especially petty offenders, out of jail, redirecting them into other programs. But you've just spoken to that. I was wondering if you had just more general thoughts about this notion of redemption. I mean, what does that mean to you? And are there more things maybe that we could do than the ones you've already spoken about to redirect the paths of some of those that are found guilty of these smaller crimes?
Again, I've heard my opponent say that, and he has indicated, consistent with the Working Families Party line, that there are a series of crimes he's simply not going to prosecute. He hasn't listed them, but if he's consistent with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia or Rachel Rollins in Boston, it will be 14, 15 crimes, including drug offenses, petty larceny, shoplifting, minor robbery offenses. I think that's disastrous, because when you say not prosecute, you have to understand that prosecution is a chain with many links. The chain starts with a crime. The next link is an arrest or an investigation. Then there's an arraignment. If you eliminate everything after that, you are simply saying, okay, we're overburdened, which we're not, and it's a minor crime, which it's not a minor crime to a storekeeper to have $800 stolen from him and then have the kid just walk back in a store a month later and do the same thing. Under my approach, which I've been consistent with over the years, is we will deal with the underlying issue. Did you steal because you're just a rotten human being, and because you steal, then we're going to lock you up, shouldn't we? Did you steal because your parents are getting divorced and you want attention? Did you steal because you're a drug addict? Did you steal diapers and baby formula from the store? Or did you go in and steal, you know, steak, lobster, and a six-pack of beer? And that's been my philosophy. So when I hear that leveled as a criticism to me, I go, where have you been? I've been promoting this agenda not only on the local level, but on the state level and the national level for my entire adult career.
So different question now. When you and I had our individual interview a little while ago, we talked a little bit about gun policy. Mm-hmm. I had another question about that, and it's something actually I've been wondering a lot about, and I wanted to get your reactions to it. When you look at the overall statistics on homicides, first of all, death by rifle is a tiny sliver of mm-hmm. that. And it's even a tiny sliver if you just look at gun homicides, still right. death by rifle. Yet mass shootings, and even more specifically than just at the level of the rifle as an instrument, the type of rifle that is used in these mass shootings, that seems to be driving right now our national conversation about what to do about guns. It's mm-hmm. all about that. And children across the nation are increasingly being enrolled in these active shooter exercises in right. their schools. I think that raises the family sense of danger, I would imagine, through the roof. And it, you know, it could provide the clear impression that, hey, this is an imminent threat. This could happen tomorrow. Even though, as horrific as those events are, the numbers, when you add these things up, they just don't bear that out. So I guess I'd like to get your thoughts about, are we having the right kinds of conversations about gun regulation and policy that we should be having? Should they be framed differently? Are they missing the target, I guess, to use a bad pun here? But, you know, what are your thoughts about that?
My thoughts are that almost a year ago to the day, a task force that I created, the Onondaga County School Safety Task Force, put out, I think, a phenomenal 25-page report that dealt with every issue that you just covered. It's available on my website on gov.net, and you can click on the DA's office, or you can just call me. I'll send it to you. And we made a number of, I think, very, very common-sense recommendations. What you just talked about, active shooter, there's a very, very big debate going on in schools right now. Do we want the, I'll call it the more militaristic approach to active shooters, you know, the armed officers coming in, everybody diving, and I've seen, and again, these are decisions for school districts, but I've seen some evidence that kids get really shook up by that, as do parents. Another avenue, which one of our co-chairs, Jackie Schallkraut, implemented in the Syracuse School District, I think my preliminary reports are it's getting an A+, our SRP, Standard Response Protocol. It's much more low-key. It has to do with verbal cues, you know, lock down, lock out, run, hide, you know, in simple, five or six simple verbal cues to kids on what you should do. But we explored all of those issues, made some recommendations. And, you know, gun control is, Grant, is a topic that's going to, you know, linger on long before you and I are pushing daisy somewhere. And it's, I just wish people would talk about it in a calm, rational manner. I mean, since, I think, 1920, it's been illegal to own a machine gun in the United States of America. That was federal law. And then with the Heller decision in 2008, Scalia and the majority of the Supreme Court said the Second Amendment is a personal right. And there's a lot of disagreement amongst scholars about that, but that's the law. Mm-hmm. And then you get into questions about, do you really need bump stocks? Do you need, you know, massively high-capacity magazine? The vast majority overwhelming majority of mass shootings in America are gang-related. School-related shootings, despite the coverage, are slim. They're minuscule, your chances of getting shot at a school. With that said, is it okay to say, oh, you know, only 14 kids were killed at Parkland. Why shouldn't let's just ignore that? No, Nicholas Cruz might as well have taken an ad out in the New York Times and said, I'm going to shoot up this school. And every sensible institution whose job it is to protect children flunked. And those kids died. For example, did you know that most of the kids died from bleeding out? That was one of the things the task force recommended, was that we have active training from professional nurses to teach kids how to stop the bleed. It sounds terrible that you got to that point, but most of the kids died because these idiot cops, one of whom I think is now under indictment, were preventing people from going in. Another problem they had was they were saying, well, building 12. Nobody knew what building 12 meant. Now we've got an app in Onondaga County where every first responder can get on the app and say, okay, this is the Lafayette School. This is the Fayetteville Manlius. I can get it. When somebody says building 12, I know where that is. And we could go on and have another show about that. But thanks for asking that.
We only have a few seconds left. I've got one last lightning round question. So if you could keep your answer extremely brief, I mean like a sentence, okay? I got to ask you this question about national politics. Are you, for our listeners, we are talking on October 1st. Just make that clear. Things can change quickly here. Do you support what Congress is doing to pursue a formal impeachment inquiry into President Trump?
I do not, because I don't think it follows tradition and the law. There should be a vote whether or not to proceed with a formal impeachment, just as a simple matter of fairness. I'm not opining as to whether or not the president should be impeached. But on the day you and I are talking, I'm having Alec Baldwin at a fundraiser of mine, and he's conflicted about whether or not the president should be impeached because he wants four more years of entertainment. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think Saturday Night Live is conflicted about that. That was Bill Fitzpatrick. And again, the election for Onondaga County District Attorney is November 5th. District Attorney Fitzpatrick, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Grant, very much.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.